Everybody's going to be really happy with it. So I want to just welcome everybody for being here. It's a beautiful day outside. It was kind of hard to enter a building.
We made that comment. Can we have it outside?
That's right. It's kind of hard, but we're all here, and I thank everybody for giving up their time and attending with this. I just want to remind individuals here, especially those who are Zooming in, that we do offer time for public comment at the end of the agenda process. So those of you that are joining in, if you use your raise hand button, that'll help us follow. We'll make sure that we all get to hear what you have to say and get your questions answered. I'm hoping, do we have a quorum to go ahead and vote on our minutes. Yes. Hopefully everybody's had a time on the board to look over the minutes from our March 9th meeting. And if we do have one, I'm going to ask for a motion to accept those.
Looks like we need one more still.
Well, then I'm just going to kind of just skip over. We do have a couple new advisory folks with us and that we want to welcome and thank them for being here. We have David Alsop. Is he in the room or is he?
He didn't know if he was going to be able to make it to this meeting.
Okay.
So we will officially welcome him.
Okay. And he's going to take the position of a corporate representative. But we do have Alberta, okay, loosely. Thank you.
Everyone here.
Yeah, so she is going to be a representative from Head Start.
Yep.
And do you know what? Will you please just take a moment, introduce yourself?
I actually work for Centro de la Familia here in Salt Lake. I'm their education director. I've been with them for 14 years. And so I represent Centro on the board of UHSA. The association here in Utah, and so they've asked me to participate. We have partnership programs here in Salt Lake, and so I've worked with licensing through some of our child care partners. So, and I love licensing. I'm excited to be part of it.
Well, welcome. Thank you so much. How are we doing there?
Now we have a quorum.
Oh, great. So I'm going to ask for a motion to accept the March 9th minutes.
Make a motion to accept the March 9th minutes.
Thank you, John. And we have a second from Elizabeth. Do we have any discussion? Has anybody noticed anything that needs to be changed? No? Great. Well, then I'm going to ask for a vote. All those in favor of accepting the March 9th committee meeting minutes, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Great. It looks like those minutes have been accepted. Thank you. So just to let people aware that we've had some individuals attending for some board members today. So we have Sarah Atherton, and she's here representing or attending for Simone Bolivar. We have Crystal Nippers attending for Katie Richard. We have Tanaya, I hope I said that right, Tom, is attending for Tracy Lund. And it looks like Eleanor is here for Tim. Okay, we're just going to move right along. It looks like things are going well. So I'm going to turn the time over to Rebecca.
Great. I just have two items that I wanted to provide an update for you. At this time of the meeting, I'll have more later, don't worry. I just wanted to let you know, in March, we had a federal monitoring opportunity. So we had our federal team, it was a virtual monitoring, come and look at different aspects of our CCDF funding and how we're using it. I had hoped that we would have some initial results, and by the time for at this meeting, and we don't. But some of the things that we were asked to look at, or that they looked at during this time, is they looked at our customer education. We did a lot of work with child care licensing and looked at our licensing policies and procedures, our subsidy policies and procedures, our provider orientations, and we also looked at our accountability. What are our policies and procedures around identifying fraud, addressing overpayments, and receiving those payments back? And so we had a really good visit. They were here for about 3 days. They reviewed our policies, our procedures, and then they actually looked at specific case files with our eligibility services division and also with child care licensing. So when we get our results and things that we get to relook at or make changes, we'll let you know. The next thing that I want to do is introduce you to our newest OCC employee, Trina Valdez. Is she here or online?
She's online.
I don't know if she has her camera, but Trina Valdez is new to Megan's team, and she is serving as an out-of-school time program specialist. So if you remember her name, and she will be contacting some of you with different aspects of that program. That's it. Thank you.
Okay, so Catherine. Ruchlin, and if I mess up your name, I'm sorry, is here to speak on the cost of care analysis.
Can I do it?
Please.
Yes. So, Catherine, before you start, Catherine is with the University of Utah, and we've asked her to give an update on a contract that we have with them, and she can, I'll just give you a brief overview. If you guys remember, in the last legislative session, there was a bill that did not pass, but it asked our department to look at some research about the cost of quality care and maybe an alternative method to how we determine some of our rates. And so we had indicated in those discussions that this is something that we had thought about and already had in process. And so this is that process that we wanted to share. And so Catherine will give us an update on what she's working on and ask some feedback of this group. Thanks. Go ahead, Catherine. Thank you.
Thank you. Tell me, am I responsible for these slides? Am I capable of moving them forward on my own, or is this somebody else in charge of those?
If you just want to let myself know, Montana, I can go to the next slide for you.
Okay, great. Thanks, Montana. Well, thank you so much for allowing me to be here with you today. I really hoped to be there in person, and then my family contracted COVID. So I'm in quarantine and hoping my voice holds up for this conversation. I really benefited from interactions with this panel during the process of the market rate survey, which I think many of you were involved with during 2020 and 2021 when we designed the survey, administered the survey, and eventually analyzed and reported those results. I was the author of that report, and as was mentioned before, I'm an economist at the University of Utah, and I work in a group of policy-oriented economics researchers called the Economics Evaluation Unit. Montana, will you go to the next slide for me? Thank you very much. This cost of quality study that we're about to start talking about is actually part of the same federal reporting requirements that the market rate study was a part of. Underneath the Administration for Children and Families and the CCDF, there is a requirement through the CCDF that agencies evaluate providers' costs of providing quality child care with the goal that subsidized families can afford child care that's of the same quality as other families in the market. And again, as was mentioned, the local legislature is also paying attention to these cost issues in the child care market. In particular, the language of HB 375, interestingly, highlighted a few specific points like being able to evaluate the wage and salary and other compensation of child care professionals and how changes in that compensation would affect the market for child care. I think right now there's really a spotlight on the industry and people are trying to understand in general, what it's going to take to meet the needs of childcare on both sides of the market, both the suppliers of childcare facing increasing costs in this sort of extraordinary context of kind of challenging labor market and supply chain issues, and then on the demand side of this market as well. Previously, before the COVID epidemic, you know, it was a lot of these analysis just kind of evaluated the cost and said, well, childcare is expensive, and it's not really enough just to say childcare is expensive anymore. I think with all of the attention that's being paid to issues of childcare, the model that we are developing now will hopefully give us the ability to envision the kind of care that we want to make possible for Utah's children and simultaneously confront the reality of what it's going to take to achieve that care. And I think that's really the intention behind both the federal reporting requirement and the local legislature's attention to this issue. And hopefully you'll see, as we explain the model, how we'll be able to do that. Could you please go to the next slide, Montana? So this cost model is going to be a fairly versatile tool. It starts from a basis of looking at existing data about all of the input costs to producing services in the childcare market, and from the basis of the criteria that are established for the quality ratings levels through the CCQS, the Child Care Quality System of Utah. Now, in the model itself, what we'll be able to do is change that cost data in order to understand how changes in prices for those inputs will change the budgetary pressures facing providers. And we'll be able to change the assumptions embedded about how providers achieve those higher ratings tiers in order to show how changes in policy or changes in consumer demands or other factors will change those budgetary pressures as well. So this model serves a range of initial goals, but also provides a lot of flexibility for future applications. First off, what it does is set up a baseline estimate of child care costs per child that looks across different sectors of the market in Utah. So it can look regionally, it can look by provider type, it can look by age of child, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then it will show the spending that drives higher costs associated with reaching those higher ratings tiers of the CCQS. Then, hopefully, we will think through how changes in other markets that child care providers rely on affect the cost of care. So in particular, if we want to, say, understand how attracting and retaining highly qualified child care workers is impacted by competition in competing employment sectors where wages are rising, we'll be able to input that information into this model in order to see what a sustainable employment model for providers would look like. And then finally, we'll be able to use the model to see how the high costs providers face can leave gaps in the market. So whether those gaps are limiting the kind of quality-related investments that that providers choose in order to achieve higher ratings tiers, or whether those gaps reflect, you know, the affordability on the consumer side of child care. All right, Montana, please switch the slide for me. Thank you. So Utah's child care cost model is going to be specific to Utah because it draws on local data. It starts from the costs actually experienced by providers who are participating in that CCQS at each tier. One of the interesting things about Utah's CCQS quality designations is that it uses a point system as opposed to a block system. So providers have the flexibility to attain points to achieve higher quality tiers across domains. And the model framework that we're building is relying on the actual quality-related investments of providers in each tier based on that market rate survey. So not just kind of setting up scenarios assuming, you know, higher quality providers do this or do this or do this, but looking at what the actual quality-related investments are of those providers. The parameters of the model, or the conditions of the model, are also informed by the data that was collected from the Utah providers through our market rate survey. So that survey took place in the fall and winter of 2020. And in that survey, we have a fairly robust sample of CCQS participants for center-based care. And we've weighted those participants in our most recent data in order to reflect the full capacity in the market and the geography of the child care supply across the state. Now, I know there's been a lot of changes in the child care market since 2020. Obviously, costs are rising. We've inflated the data that's related to monetary values in those survey responses to the most recent estimates we have available. I would definitely be interested in your feedback on other changes in the market that are maybe creating new pressures besides just dollar value changes, right? So as we go through this material or maybe in follow-up emails or conversations to this meeting, if you have any feedback about that, about the changes in pressures since the survey time period, which ended in December 2020, then I would be really interested to hear those. Importantly, the model isn't going to highlight any individual provider's costs. So we won't see maybe results that directly map one-to-one on the exact expenses of a specific provider in the market. What we're going to see are the average costs for each ratings tier according to the inputs they use to produce child care services, and consider those average costs by the subsets of the market. Okay, please switch forward to the slide. Now, what I really hope to gain from this meeting is your insights on the elements of the model that drive higher costs. How the model treats these variables shows up in the results of the model, so we really want to get it right. And in the following slides, we're going to be looking at center-licensed facilities in particular, because we haven't yet aggregated the data on family-licensed providers who are participating in the quality rating system, so we don't have that yet. But I can show you what we know so far on the center-licensed side. And one thing that's well-known is that, you know, for all providers, 70 to 80% of total costs are personnel costs. So this is the cost of hiring and retaining staff, including, you know, teachers spending time in the classroom, but also all of the costs associated with responsibilities outside of the classroom, such as curriculum planning or family engagement activities, and the tendency of these costs to increase as providers strive to meet the elements of the CCQS at those higher ratings tiers. So taking on quality investments that require more personnel time, either inside the classroom or outside of the classroom, is going to lead to significant cost increases. So these are changes in the structure of the childcare facility, like reducing group sizes or the number of children per staff member, or these are things like investments in training or professional development. Those are our personnel cost drivers in the market. Of course, there are also non-personnel costs that can be substantial cost drivers as well. We know rent and insurance are major expenses, but we can also see with this model how unclaimed revenue can actually drive these budget pressures. So, for example, if enrollment drops below 100% of capacity, or if families can't pay their bills on time, that shifts the cost burden onto providers, and those kinds of changes can have a significant impact as well. Okay, next slide, please, Montana. So in the Utah data, we look at these cost drivers, or these elements of child care costs across the ratings tier, and see how spending on those elements varies tier by tier. And those differences become the parameters that delineate the model. And I'm going to show you a few of these differences across the following slides. So what we find are different sized providers by quality ratings tiers. We find that there are more teachers per child at higher quality ratings tiers, that there is higher pay for all positions at higher quality rated tiers, and that there are a number of other investments that factor in to these differences. And these are elements for which your feedback is very important for me. So there's a question in the chat asking, Dr. Rushlam, can you address why you won't be collecting individual expenditure information from providers? The market rate survey collected individual expenditure information from providers. There were three sections of that survey that specifically asked. One of the sections was called key cost drivers. One of the sections was called questions on the child care workforce and wages. And then there was another section on characteristics of the program. Characteristics of the program asked about things like curriculum planning, child assessments, things like that. So that's where we got the data that feeds this model from individual provider responses to the market rate survey. The workforce and wages section asked for providers to report the number of staff and the minimum and maximum wages paid to those staff across, about a dozen different positions, including teachers by lead teacher, assistant teacher, and age group, directors, assistant directors, administrative staff, consultants, et cetera. So we got provider-level data for those wages and staffing decisions. And then the key cost drivers section asked about things like benefits, investments in employee training, and other things like that. So the data that informs this model actually is that individual level expenditure information from providers. And like I said, it's from fall and winter of 2020. So, if you have input on how that may have changed in the time since then, that's definitely relevant for this model. Could you flip to the next slide, please, Martina? Okay. So the cost model measures costs in per child terms. So we'll get, the X dollars per child cost of infant care, the X dollars per child cost for preschool care, right? There are two kinds of costs that go into calculating that number. Costs that occur at the facility level are things like the salary of the director. So, these are things that are in service of all of the children in care. They're not associated with any particular classroom. Those facility level costs in the model are summed up and divided over all of the children at the facility. And then there are costs at the classroom level, and these are things like the presence of a lead teacher and an assistant teacher or a part-time assistant teacher or a teacher's aide. And those are calculated just for students in the classroom. And that way, differences in spending by age group are reflected at the classroom level, and those show up as differences in per child costs age by age. Okay, can I flip to the next slide, please? So this slide shows the reported group size from that survey data from the market rate survey, and it looks at the reported group size by CCQS rating. And we have three ratings categories here, certified foundation of quality, certified building quality, and then the combined group certified high quality and certified high quality plus. There are also the default foundation of quality category for folks who aren't participating in a CCQS. I have analyzed the data for those groups too. I haven't put them on the slide because that group appears to have much more variation within it. And so it is not quite as clear-cut as the distinctions between the tiers that we'll see over the next couple of slides. The group size and capacity of the firm is important. It's one of the fundamental assumptions of this model because a smaller group size means fewer children in the classroom, and the costs that are spread over children are spread over fewer children, making the per student cost higher. What we see on this slide is that starting at age three, the group size gets smaller as we move up the higher ratings to higher ratings tiers. Interestingly about this data is that all of the group sizes for all three of these ratings categories meet the higher quality standards set by the CCQS. So group size is not one of the areas where providers are choosing to achieve higher quality points that push them into the certified building or high quality categories. In fact, across the board, providers are meeting those higher quality standards on this measure. But we do see that higher ratings tiers are going, you know, beyond the quality standard with reductions in group sizes, especially for older aged kids. The difference in capacity that we see here at the bottom of the slide is a result of those smaller group sizes. So, you know, if all of the facilities have, say, just one classroom at each age group, a facility with bigger group sizes is going to have a larger capacity. And the reported group sizes in the data match up almost, you know, almost perfectly within a very small range of error with the licensed capacity. So most providers are looking for group sizes like at their licensed capacity, trying to fill to capacity. The impact of these different group sizes is going to be already we know that what we'll see are higher per child costs for higher rated providers because those costs are spread over fewer children. Okay. To the next slide, please, Montana. Actually, we can skip this one and go to the next one, please. Okay, so this slide shows how those smaller group sizes and smaller capacities result in those higher per child costs at higher tiers. And it just looks at a set of examples from those facility level costs that are spread over all children. So one of them is rent. And the price per square foot of rent in this model is based on the average cost of commercial space in Utah. It's a weighted average, so it represents geographic differences in that cost, but there's little data available at the rural level, so it may not fully represent the spectrum of prices available. In addition, the state licensing requirements require 35 feet of indoor space per child, and that doesn't include, you know, bathrooms, offices, hallways, and 40 feet of outdoor space per child using the outdoor space at a time. Now, the national kind of convention in these cost models is to assume that facilities use a space equal to 80 square feet per child. Our Utah local licensing requirements don't necessarily line up perfectly with that 80 square feet per child, but it is sort of the accepted standard for child care experts across the country. This is one of those issues that if you have feedback, I would be interested in it because it's looking at national level data. So rent is calculated as the price per square foot times 80 square feet per child. And so as you can see from this table, you end up with larger facilities, so those in the Certified Foundation of Quality category, spending more money on rent. But because rent is one of those factors that varies with the size of the facility, the per child expense is actually the same across the board. The next category category of spending on that slide is internet and telephone, and internet and telephone are what's called fixed costs. They don't change with the number of kids at the facility. Instead, you have the same cost divided across more children, meaning lower per child costs at small facilities, or fewer children and thus higher per child costs at those larger facilities in the high quality and high quality plus categories. These types of expenditures, these fixed costs, are the source of what are called economies of scale at those larger capacity facilities. This is the way that, you know, increasing your facility size spreads those fixed costs over more children and results in smaller costs per child. And then there are the personnel costs, and these are personnel costs that accrue at the facility level. On the slide are director salaries and administrative staff salaries. And what we see is that director salaries are higher at higher quality rated tiers, and the same is true for the administrative staff. So the survey data tells us that the typical firm in each of these tiers is employing a director and at least one administrative staff, like an office manager. So the presence of this staff is not a source of cost differences in Utah. But at higher rated centers, the combination of those higher wage and salary payments and fewer students mean big differences in the impact of these salaries in terms of per child costs. So these are the sources of cost differences by quality, both because those firms are paying higher salaries and because they're spreading those facility level costs across fewer children. Okay, to the next slide, please. One of the other key structural elements of this model is the staff to child ratio. As you can see from this table, for infants and one-year-olds, the ratios are the same across quality tiers. Starting at age two, we see consistent reductions in the number of kids per adult as the ratings tier increases. These differences are one domain where higher rated facilities are choosing to invest in quality related expenses. So these differences are very closely matched to the CCQS framework. In fact, the Certified Foundation of Quality categories reported staff to child ratios match up exactly to the licensing standard. And then the certified building quality category mainly achieves those 1 point quality points with their staff per child ratios. And then the certified high quality and high quality plus facilities earn the 2 points toward their quality domain by achieving those even higher standards. So it's quite interesting that these line up so perfectly. And these differences in staff-child ratios, again, will result in pretty substantial cost differences across the tiers. So if you could go to the next slide. I'm just going to use these and the group sizes to talk a little bit about the assumptions made at the classroom level. So for simplicity, we're assuming a similar staffing structure in classrooms across all of the providers, with one lead teacher and one assistant teacher in the classroom, with a classroom that's open for 10 hours a day, and to represent non-classroom time of the teaching staff, differences in classroom coverage costs as lead teachers spend time in breaks, in planning, or in training activities or other types of activities as outside of the classroom. So the assumptions in the numbers you're about to see, and these are not finalized, and again, an area where I would love to have your feedback, is that at the Certified Foundation of Quality level, there is staff coverage in the classroom that essentially amounts to a one hour of break time for the lead teacher and the assistant teacher per day. So an additional quarter of a staff member to cover those periods throughout the week. At the certified building quality level, the model assumes that there's a little bit more teacher coverage to support the lead teacher spending time outside of the classroom. So 0.3% of a full-time staff member, which would cover that same one-hour break for each teacher in the class, plus, you know, an additional 2.4 hours a day or about 2 hours a week for something like curricular planning. And then at the high quality or high quality plus ratings level, 0.35 coverage. So this would cover those same one-hour breaks plus curricular planning plus a little extra time. Now, it's possible that these assumptions overshoot how much time is being spent outside of the classroom, and this is not an area where we have good survey data. It wasn't a question on the survey. So if you guys want to think about this, the amount of time that's spent outside of the classroom in these activities, I would be very interested in hearing your feedback. Okay, so to the next slide, just to demonstrate how the assumptions plus the staff-child ratio and the group size lead to distinctions in per-child costs. I have this slide. There's actually a typo on this slide because I made these slides when my kids didn't have any childcare, so, which is a very dangerous thing to do. but these show how the teaching costs, so the classroom-level costs, vary by providers' quality ratings tier. So the staff-child ratio tells us how many staff per child in the classroom, and the group size tells us how many children are in the classroom. And then those lead teacher and assistant teacher median wages, those are from the survey data. And the survey data specifically asked for wages for lead and assistant teachers for infants, for toddlers, and for preschoolers. And there are significant differences in the wages paid in each of those categories, even under the same kind of lead teacher title. So what we see is that, you know, for these certified high quality and high quality plus providers, we have higher lead teacher wages, higher assistant teacher wages, and those alone are enough to drive higher costs. So the monthly per child cost should actually be $780 in that last category, significantly higher than certified building quality providers because of the higher wages paid to the teachers in the classroom. And at the infant level, the wages are the sole driving factor of those cost differences, because what we see from the data is that at the infant and one-year-old classrooms, the staff-to-child ratio and group sizes are consistent regardless of quality ratings tier. So it's really these differences in wages that are driving costs. Now, the wages that are represented here, these aren't total compensation. These are just wage and salary income. They don't include benefits, and they don't include things like paid leave time. They don't include the cost of having substitute teachers when teachers are out. And so there are additional costs that will be factored that will drive these classroom costs even higher ultimately in this model. You can flip to the next slide, please. Although this has reflects that same data error, this bar graph, excuse me, I'm sorry. This bar graph is those classroom level costs added to the total facility level costs. And what you see in this graph is that the cost of infant care is quite expensive at any quality rating level, right? You know, almost $1,400 per infant at certified foundation and quality, and those costs actually increase by tier. Okay, to the next slide, please. Excuse me, I'm sorry. Okay, so I did the same exercise for toddlers and preschool classrooms, and you know, these numbers are very preliminary because, as I said, there is still a lot of data to analyze, and there's a lot of fine-tuning of the model to be done, especially after I receive any kind of feedback you guys can offer. But this is essentially the same exercise for 2- and 3-year-olds. And what we see in this data is that at higher quality rated tiers, we have the impact of both higher wages and smaller group sizes and higher staff child ratios. I'm sorry, more staff per children, driving those increases in costs. And so we see the same pattern of rising costs due to those three factors. Could you flip forward two more slides? Yeah, and this is the same data for preschool classrooms, which again, there are substantial differences in the group size. The differences in group size get wider as the age of the children increases. So we see that having a bigger impact in the preschool classroom than in the classrooms before. Okay, two more slides, sorry. One more, sorry. So, basically, I think that I hope that we can make this an opportunity to improve the model as it stands. The main asset of a Utah-specific model is setting up the parameters using Utah-specific information, and that's why your feedback is so important to this process. I think there are a few places where improvements are likely to be found, and that's what I've listed on this slide. The first, it says review of facility-level non-personnel costs. There are a number of elements that we did not ask about in the market rate survey. It was already excruciatingly long, if you remember filling it out, and so we couldn't ask about every single element, like how much is your phone bill, and so some of those facility-level costs are taken from the national average, and if those depart from Utah costs, then that would be something interesting to know. The second point under the issues is teacher time in non-classroom activities, and that's what I was mentioning before. You know, the assumptions made about how much time is spent in curricular planning, in family engagement, in training and development, and all of those things will factor into the cost based at the classroom level. And then an additional thing that we couldn't ask about in the market rate survey was whether some of the positions that are listed were full-time or part-time. So we had assistant teachers in every facility and assistant directors and consultants, but no information about whether those positions were staffed at a full-time level. So differences by full-time and part-time employment would be good to know as well, not just for teachers, but also for all of the other non-teaching staff at the facility. One thing that I'm very interested in that doesn't appear in any of these models generally, because these really examine ongoing costs, is the potential for there to be really large sunk costs, one-time costs, incurred in the process of moving from one quality ratings level to the next quality ratings level. Maybe one has to make a large investment in materials or outdoor space or something like that. That's not recognized as an ongoing cost, but prevents a significant barrier from moving to tier to tier. That data is not really available anywhere at the national level or at the local level, although the National Academy of Sciences has posed some ideas for where those costs might appear. And then finally, there's this question of what is the true cost of care, which is not just the cost of care as we experience it on a day-to-day level, but what it really would take to provide the type of care that providers want to provide, to have the kind of sustainability of providers that would make the market durable, to have the kind of highly qualified staff in the classroom that would improve quality across the board, to have the kind of infrastructure for care available at the state level. What sort of additional costs, I think, providers see as they attempt to fill those needs kind of on the day-to-day level and run into roadblocks? I think that's a question that this model would be very good at addressing. So any input you have into those costs is interesting as well. The last slide on this was just informational. Montana, could you, this is just those facility level costs. These are from the national level estimates from the provider cost of quality care calculator. This is the ACF's national level cost modeling tool, and these are the values drawn from that tool. So these are the assumptions that are used kind of to broadly address those facility level costs, including food and food preparation, you know, office supplies and things like that. So any divergences that we have in Utah from these estimates is what that first point on the previous slide was referring to. Okay, I know that I've talked well beyond my voice's reach, but also probably your attention spans. So I'm going to stop. I hoped that we would have time for feedback now, but I know it's also a lot to think about, and it might be something that you want to mull over and get back to me. So I don't think my email address is on these slides, and I should have put it on the cover slide, but I can circulate that in the chat so that anyone who doesn't want to offer feedback during this meeting could get back to me in the future. Right. Thank you, Montana. I appreciate your help.
Thank you, Catherine. I appreciate it. Yeah. Simone? Which would be
Sarah?
Maybe Sarah?
Oh, thank you. No, I am in attendance. Sarah will present for me, but I am attending the meeting. I just have a quick question on this study. I can see that how all the information was based on single age groups and group sizes. Was there any consideration of mixed age groups and how that affect the cost if providers were to practice mixing ages? Because that varies group sizes and ratios.
Yeah, the survey does not allow us. I mean, we can make assumptions about that. And it would be very easy to add assumptions about age group mixes to this model instead of modeling, say, 3-year-olds and 4-year-olds, model a 3- and 4-year-old classroom. That's no problem. That's an adjustment to the model that can be made. You know, kind of with a click in an Excel cell. However, the data that we have doesn't lend itself to directly extrapolating specific costs for a mixed age group. And that's because the survey asked for group sizes and staff child ratios in a variety of ways, but ultimately, you know, to reduce the complexity of the survey, age by age was the most straightforward and where the answers are most verifiably kind of clear in the data.
Thank you. Yes, I understand the complexity of entering mixed age groups. It is a practice. But can I ask another question?
Yeah.
I believe that the administrative costs included licensing costs, like background check costs, fingerprints, and all those things.
That's right. So there is an assumption at the national level that fees and permits, that's where I would put those costs. That's on this last slide that we're actually looking at now. The national level assumption about that is $500. When it comes to just licensing fees and things like that, that seems pretty high, but adding in all of those finger background checks, et cetera, I think falls under that category. So that's one of those areas where I'm not sure if providers are really hitting $500 in fees and permits, including, those background checks or not. And this would be, you know, per facility per year.
Catherine, can I ask a question?
Yes, go.
Yeah.
So I have a question about the regional differences you talked about. There are so many regions in Utah that don't have certain tiers of quality, and so I'm wondering how you pull data? Do you just use other regions and infer, or what? How do you do that?
So I haven't broken this down for areas like frontier regions, which are unlikely to have even a few observations in the data. But one, there are a couple of ways that this is being done. One is looking at metropolitan and non-metropolitan statistical areas, which group areas together. So although there are, you know, 25 counties represented in the data, we can boil those down to, you know, 8 metropolitan statistical areas. These are things like the Salt Lake region, Ogden, you know, things like that. And that is the geographic delineations used in a lot of economic data to understand essentially delineations between markets, commuting zones, et cetera. That doesn't give us the full range of geographic detail that we would want. When it comes to things like frontier areas, which are, you know, areas that are, you know, 25 miles away from a population center, looking at basically differences in the cost of living, the local cost of living, are what would guide those estimates. So say, you know, that we know the cost for Utah overall, and we know, excuse me, that the cost of living in these areas is, you know, X percent away from that cost. So.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah, Hannah, there's a lot of those facility level costs that are pretty low, but I don't know when you average everything out if it would make a huge difference on a per child basis. But yeah, there's a lot of things that are really low on this sheet at least.
Anything? What jumps out at you?
Well, and it's covered up. Let's see. So the now all the salaries are going to be quite a bit higher now than they were back in 2020. We've seen kind of an average per teacher cost go to at least $15 an hour across the board. So that's different. But on this page, your insurance might be low. Telephone and internet is really low. I mean, I think we're paying on average about $350 a month for telephone and internet.
Wow.
Per facility. Fees and permits. Right now, a lot of those costs are being covered by COVID relief funds. But when that isn't the case, you would be in the probably $3,000 or $4,000 a year in fees and permits. When you include background check fees, state licensing fees, county health licensing fees, and city licensing fees. In addition to the kitchen permits, they charge a fee for the fire marshal to come out, and they charge a fee for a separate building inspection for your city license. So it's much higher than that. But again, when you look at spreading that out across, you know, 85 to 150 children, I don't know if it would make a huge difference in your cost model. So, I mean, we can pick at a lot of things, but I don't know if they would make a huge difference in the end, you know.
Okay. I'll think about that and see if I can find some other sources. I want to mention, in response to your comment about wages, I know that there are strong wage pressures in this market. In fact, wages in this market, in Utah in general, and across the United States, have not increased as fast as inflation. So the numbers in this data inflate with inflation. So they're actually a higher estimated change in wages than something like the employer cost index suggests. So let me just mention a couple of things. So the Bureau of Labor Statistics reports wages by occupation. So they have childcare worker, preschool teacher, and director of child care preschool facilities in that data. They only have data up through May 2021. So it misses the majority of the inflation in that market that happened after May 2021. So I don't have any statistical evidence to base inflating those specific wages on differently than the rest of the market. Up through May 2021, from May 2020 to 21, wages of child care workers only increased 3.5%. I mean, that's quite a big increase compared to previous years, but it's not as much, I think, as the cost pressures that we're really facing. When you look at data that goes through the end of 2021, which is about as recent as we can get, you know, by broad occupations, what we see is that in the service sector, wages increased 7.1%, which is actually on par with inflation. So inflation over that period was 7%, service sector wages increased 7.1%. So the numbers in this, for the wages in this presentation, inflate according with those numbers. We don't really have, until the next BLS report comes out, which is going to be March of 2023, we won't know what wages for child care workers in Utah were in 2022. So so there's a bit of a lag there that's not being represented. So I appreciate what you're saying about those changes. This is, I think, a good sort of middle ground to represent the changes in that industry. And in fact, when I look at the inflated numbers, they line up pretty well with the wage distribution for Utah for these occupations. So,
how big of a sample would you need of existing providers to share payroll data with you to feel comfortable about adjusting that based on Utah numbers?
How big a sample do they need?
Grant is having that information turned in monthly right now.
I mean, data like that is every economist's dream. So, you know, certainly I would be open to attaining it. But how big a sample would I need to be reliable? Well, I would need to be able to identify, for the purposes of this model, I would need to be able to identify firms by their quality ratings tier. So I would need, so it couldn't be kind of de-identified data. So that sometimes poses a problem in this kind of data collection. I think probably, we would need, you know, more than half of providers to respond to that, so to really be a good sample.
And I think our office could work with Catherine. I know those questions in there about using our stabilization graph payroll information. We're only collecting it for those providers that are paying their staff a minimum of $15 per hour. And so that may skew what data we would have available, but we could definitely continue this conversation, Catherine, with our office and see what we might have to support that or not.
That would be wonderful. I appreciate it. That's great. Who should I follow up with to for that?
Rebecca.
Rebecca, would you send me an email since I don't have yours?
Yes, I will send that with you. Or between my staff, we'll schedule a follow-up meeting after this.
Great, thank you.
And who employed the U of U to do this? Was it the Office of Child Care? Or?
Yes, yeah. Okay.
Yeah, it was the Office of Child Care.
Yeah. I think, sorry, Catherine, did you have anything else?
No. I was just going to mention that. Yeah, we contracted for this project. We started talking about it in 2019. Started talking about the ideas behind it. So it predated the sort of dramatic changes in the child care market over the last couple of years. So it was a very prescient decision on the OCC's part, because not a year later, everybody was turning to these issues with their full attention. So. Yeah.
Can I just add before we're done? I think kind of steps, Catherine is collecting feedback, so if you guys want to send information to her. We've asked for this report, for this model to be done by the end of the year, so just to set expectations on when we would see some of the completed work. by the end of the year. And then our office, we really contracted to, or put this work in, because every 3 years we have to do a market rate survey, or we have to look at how we are setting our subsidy rates. It could either be a market rate survey, or we could use an alternative method. In order to even be able to use an alternative method, we have to have a pre-approval through our federal office on what tool we might use and how we would set that up. And so this will provide us with information to determine how we want to go forward with the next cycle of our next reporting cycle, and then we'd be able to, if we do choose to do something different than our regular market rate survey, we could, we'll be working with our national, our federal officers to make sure we have those approvals in place to use a different tool.
So great. So was there no more questions that you have on there?
I can't read them from here. I'm sorry.
No, just Kristen Schultz said, could the stabilization grant payroll information be used?
Okay. Well, thank you, Catherine, for presenting for us today. And hopefully things stay nice and healthy for you and your home.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate your time. I'm very grateful to you. Thank you.
Okay, great. So we'll just move on. Rebecca.
Yeah. So I'm here with my regular COVID update. For those of you who have some new members, Roberta, I don't know if you've heard this before, but in case you haven't heard this or you forgot, the Office of Child Care, we received four different funding sources of COVID relief that we could use to help support the child care industry and here in Utah. You can see on this slide the funding source, the amount that was included in that funding, and when the funding has to be expended by. And so a total funding that we received was $574 million to be able to use between when that first was awarded to the last available funding stream in September of 2024. And so we're midway through that. If you'll go to the next screen, Montana. What I've been doing each time we meet is just kind of updating you on where we are with some of our funding, where we're at. We have obligated, as of now, $413 million of that total funding. And we are right now, we're in that process where we need to look at all of our current funding obligations and determine, are we going to be able to send out those funds? Do we need to repurpose? Do we need to help market? What do we need to do? And that will help inform us on what we do with the remaining funding that we haven't obligated. There may be some things that we need to carry over for an additional year. There may be some things that we've piloted and wasn't working. And so we're in that process now over the next couple of months to really evaluate where we are and what we need to carry forward. Some of the things that we've recently been asked to look at is from a different variety. Additional funding opportunities include the grant for employer and child care providers and those partnerships. This was something that came out of the legislation in March that was finalized, and I've asked my good friend Paige to check us on the board to help me convene a group to talk about what those grants should look like, what those amounts should be, what that process will happen, or what we'll do. And then we'll be able to take those recommendations and formulate our policy and our administrative rule around that. So thank you, Paige, for that. And then I really appreciate you helping me with that. I don't want to steal anyone's thunder, so I know some of the stuff I'm going to mention.
I can steal it.
Okay, I listen, Kathy. We are going to provide some funding for child care providers that were not eligible for the stabilization grant. The stabilization grant funds had a hard rule that you had to be licensed before a certain date. And we've had providers that have been licensed after that date that still have those same needs. They still have the same barriers to obtaining and retaining staff. And so we're going to use some of our CRSA funding that doesn't have that specific licensing date to run the exact same program. The exact same application as our stabilization grant, but being able to fund it out of a different source, it will provide additional opportunities for providers that have recently been licensed to participate. We have staff looking at a child care apprenticeship program. We know that some other states have done that. We're in the research and the gathering information phase about if an apprenticeship program would make sense here. We're working with the Department of Human Services on some options and some opportunities for some mental health supports for families and providers. Those could look like what we've been talking with them about is providing some contracts or some funding to be able to have child care providers connect with their local mental health office to receive some counseling, some support. Maybe they could do some community group sessions around mindfulness and about, you know, just with all child care providers in their area to be able to help provide some support that way. Or it could be, part of it could be also looking at, is there an employee assistance type program that we could contract with so providers could have the ability to call in and receive some help. For families, we're looking at using some of our funds to expand some of the work of the Children's Center with their therapeutic preschool. And so that would provide an opportunity for some families to receive some additional access to supports. Nuna's going to talk in a minute about some of the infant toddler work that we're thinking about. We've also been asked to look at shared services network. This is something that our office looked at a couple of years ago, and we've been asked by your providers and advocates to look at, does that make sense now, and we're exploring that. The other thing that's not on this list, but I'm really excited to announce, we're also in the planning phases of doing a COVID bonus for staff that work in licensed child care centers. It's going to be called our, help me out, Heather.
Youth and Early Care Workforce Bonus.
Youth and Early Care Workforce Bonus. And we are looking at having an opportunity for individual staff members to be able to apply for this by the middle of summer. And then we would verify that they are licensed, that they have completed their background check, their license, they work for one of our eligible license providers, and be able to issue a check for them. This is something that's happened within with teachers recently or before, and we wanted to be able to provide this opportunity for our workforce staff. And as we're looking at that planning, we are looking up to about $2,000 per worker. So this would be a great, you know, we can't say enough thanks, and this doesn't seem like that adequate for all the work and the stress that has gone on over COVID, but also for our new workers that are now feeling these workforce shortages that we have. It's been a rough couple of years, and so this is something that we could do to help support the workforce.
This teacher and staff.
Teacher and staff. Yep. So again, in the planning stages,
this would be with CRSA funds.
With CRSA funds, yes, with our CRSA funding. And so we are working to see that planning and hope to have more information and formally announce the details mid-summer.
There's one question. Does it include all staff, kitchen, et cetera?
Yeah, I think that's what we're trying to do. We are looking to have it be as broad as we can.
But you're including family providers as well, right?
Yeah, we're including family providers.
Good to have family providers.
Just center employees, and I think that's right.
Yeah.
Are you considering length of time?
What was that?
Length of time, like depending on how much you'll give an employee?
We were considering. I don't think we're going to do that.
Okay.
Yep.
Just curious.
Yep. It would be a
complicated.
How do you value someone's length of time over someone else's, and the amount of documentation that would be required and to verify?
Yeah.
We felt like we wanted to do something a little more broadly, but we definitely considered it.
Yeah.
And one thing we've learned is that the more complicated you make the program, the more complicated it is to administer. And and also the funds must be obligated by the end of September.
Yeah. And so we would cut that application by the end of summer to give our staff time to review and approve all those applications. They have to be approved by the end of September. And we looked at the universe, and it's 12,000 people that could be potentially eligible. So it's a significant, and so we're excited about this. Providers, use this as a marketing. We're trying to get some staff working for you before the and recruit before the application comes.
So we can start doing this now.
You have this information. You can do what you want with it.
Right now, it's a.
I just don't want to stab you in my door and say, "In June, we're going to." No,
that's
not
why we're doing the formal announcement.
No, mid-summer.
I just want you to know we're planning things you could look at.
Wonderful.
Yeah. So definitely update. update. I don't know if anyone has any questions about
Holly.
Hey, Montana. Are you limiting this youth and early care workforce bonus to those who have passed a background check? So I might. So what my question would be, if you have staff that maybe isn't old enough, like maybe 14 or 15 year olds that come in after school to help with cleaning, would they be excluded because they did not pass the background check? And I actually kind of think they should be, but is that kind of where you're cutting it off as if they had to have had a background check to qualify for this check?
Yep, that is one of the requirements that we are considering and want to implement.
That sounds good. I don't think that we, those younger employees probably don't. Probably not as much.
Great. Thank you. That's all I have.
Great. So we're going to turn the time over to Crystal with the, I'm sorry.
We were here about chocolate.
I can't even see the book.
Yes,
we were here about child care. Take it away.
Thank you. So I'm just here to report on what our plans were for the stabilization funds that our agency received. So our initial goal was to support family and center care with business resources through classes and peer learning to provide some literature that would then be able to provide some constant support resources for them. We wanted to incentivize current regulated family providers to recruit and support new providers into the business and supply materials for new family child care providers and then support some membership in some professional organizations. So next slide, Montana. So in the area of our business support, we offered classes for both center and family child care providers. Looking at some of the different business-related challenges that they face, so employee retention and business practices. We had a great group in our center. They kind of created their own little support group within there, and that was well-received. And our family class is just kind of finishing up this week, and it has been well-received as well. And they'll be getting resources in the next month. We allowed for our center program, we allowed time for them to kind of share and brainstorm ideas. It was really nice. We had a new center program that was a part of this, and he was very happy. He received lots of information, lots of great, not just beyond the idea or beyond the idea of just business, but also involving CCQS and ways that they were supporting that process and their programs and that. So it was a nice thing to see. Follow up with that. And then, like I said, they'll be getting some business-specific literature to kind of help with those same topics, employee retention and business practices in the next month. Those should be coming in. Next slide. We were able to recruit 3 family child care mentors. They were very excited to assist individuals into the process of becoming licensed and to also recruit. Quite a few of them didn't. They wanted to do it without any incentive at all, and it's has not been a well-used program, but we'll continue to see what we can do within that. There was community outreach to recruit providers, and then we had family child care startup grants for materials, and we used a checklist that supports the family child care environmental rating scale so that they would kind of be able to provide get materials to help them to be set whenever or if they choose to be interviewed within that. Yes, Holly.
Sorry, you can finish your presentation. My question is wait until you're done. You might answer it.
Okay. Next slide. On the personal development, we did a reimbursement for part of a professional organization membership fee. The idea on that was that when they're a part of those professional organizations, there's different supports that are offered, resources, and it kind of allows it provides a pathway to further professional resources for them. So we've had a few that have taken part in that. Unfortunately, we did offer a 1-year membership to conscious discipline. but we were not able to follow through with that. They did not follow the approval process or did not follow through with the approval process for completing the career ladder. We have reached out to them again. Kind of the thought behind this was a course and some free material for personal emotional wellness support for the individual caregiver, but unfortunately we weren't able to offer that, and that was kind of what our plan was for this year. So now, any questions, Holly?
Okay, sorry about that. My question was, on your family child care startup grant, what is the budget range of how much they're offering to those new providers to help cover the cost of starting up?
So this was materials, and ours was low. It was $400 that they were able to be offered, and that will probably be reevaluated for the next year.
Yeah, hopefully so. Thanks.
Any other questions? Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Okay, so it looks like we're going to go ahead and move on to our Office of Child Care update. And first on our list is Nuna.
Hi. My update is going to be far less exciting than Crystal and Rebecca, so everybody temper your expectations. As you can see, the slide is blank, so it's not just that really high expectations. So this is a follow-up of a conversation that this group started back in January, where, as a reminder, you had breakout groups to talk specifically about the issues that existed long before COVID but have been amplified by COVID, which is around infant toddler costs, capacity, statewide needs, and all of those different things. And so one thing I shared with you last time is that when I came back from leave, I really started to look at the notes and all of the brainstorming sessions that you did and tried to start categorizing some of the different areas of need and think about what we can do in our office. And so since the last time that we've met, I had a conversation with a small group of providers that were gracious with their time. I've talked to some national experts and our federal partners about strategies that were implemented in this area in other states and what are some of those best practices. And then I brought all that information back to some conversations within the Office of Child Care. And I think what I have, my takeaway at the moment is that some of the things that we would love to do that are really big in scale, we simply don't have bandwidth to do at this moment in time, and that require a lot of capacity to do very well. And in light of the fact that we're using COVID relief money, we want to be very realistic in what we can do and to be able to do it quickly and do it well. And so that brought us back to wanting to scale down to what we can offer in this area, specifically within some of our existing mechanisms. And so a lot of the things that are best practices we're already doing in the world of subsidy. And so I'm looking at and having conversations with our child care quality specialists, on what supports that we can offer within our child care quality system. So those conversations are in the early stages, so I don't have specifics to share with you, but I'm very excited about the direction that's going in, and so that's something that I'm hoping that because it is within our existing structures, we can start to offer it relatively quickly. So by the time that we meet next, there'll be a lot more detail or potentially a report out on what we're already doing and what's in place by then. So I'm very excited about it. I just wanted you to know that this is a focus for us, and as Rebecca mentioned, it's one of the areas that our COVID relief money is going towards. So we're really excited about it. Anna, did you have a question?
Yeah, I was just wondering, when you say, Nuna, that like conversations are happening, early conversations, and maybe you said this and I missed it, but with whom are those conversations happening and what exactly are they about?
Yeah, since the last time that we met, I pulled aside a group of child care providers that helped really educate me on some of the nuances that came about what the costs are related to infant and toddlers and the costs, you know, that they incur and having these classrooms and some of the challenges of maintaining that space. Then I took that conversation and turned around and talked to some national experts and our federal partners, and then brought back all of that information within the Office of Child Care to talk to some of our managers about what we can do in light of all the information that we heard and this problem, to figure out what can we roll out very quickly within our existing programs that'll help target supports for providers that have infant and toddler space. Does that help? Oh, thanks. Okay. Any other questions? Okay, that's it, Miranda.
Great. Well, for a blank page, you know what to say.
Sure.
Okay, so now we're going to move on to Kathy to talk about the stimulation grant.
Okay, so I just kind of wanted to give an update of where we are with funding. So we have dispersed about $41.5 million from January through April. And at that point, there's about 766 programs currently receiving the stabilization grant. We have had three kind of major updates within the last 2 weeks. The first one was our base rate changed from $250 per license capacity to the $350, so an additional $100 per capacity size. And then the enhanced rate increased from $300 to $400. So that should be reflective in the May checks that went out last week. And so that was a pretty big change. The second change Rebecca highlighted on is allowing the program's license after that hard March 11, 2021 date. And also commercial preschools are now allowed to apply. And those we've seen a little bump. I think we received about 50 programs that have applied within that met that qualification. And so those are with that HRSA funding. So that's good news.
Is there a number of how many programs were not eligible that were reached out to? Just curious. If you've gotten 50, I just wonder how many there were.
And we're still processing those right now. Yeah.
So like out of how many, are you asking like out of how many would
were
be,
not eligible?
Would become now eligible?
Uh-huh. Oh, probably around a little over 100.
Oh, okay. So more than half have already said,
Give it to me. that did not include the commercial preschools in that 100. That was like an additional pocket that we hadn't really considered that we reached out to.
And how are you marketing this?
We have gone to our Care About Child Care agencies. Me and my program specialist on Monday. Sorry, I don't even know what day it is today. We had a webinar and a Q&A, and so we kind of highlighted there. We have also sent communication directly to those providers, letting them know that this is an opportunity for them. We have also reached out to providers that we had previously denied because of that hard date. That here you go, now you can apply and we can help you out. So
and the commercial preschool, they are
so the commercial preschools, we're working on getting that out there. Yeah.
Hey, how are you determining license capacity in a commercial preschool?
We're just pulling that directly from child care licensing. Everything is
driven. So they still have to be a state licensed entity.
What's
considered
a commercial?
Yeah, I'm lost.
What's
the difference?
So, I don't think maybe Simone could come in. A commercial preschool is a relatively new licensing type that child care licensing including. And it's for, and Simone, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but it's for preschools, so they're only a couple of hours per day. But they're not in a home, but they're not also in a child care center. So there's these standalone preschool programs that are happening outside of a home. Simone, did I slaughter that definition?
No, you did right. These are independent preschools. They're commercial facilities. They're not preschools at any residential place. You did great.
Thank you.
There's one question, Kristen Schultz. What percentage of the recipients are receiving the enhanced rate?
We don't have the exact numbers of that, but we anticipate it's at least 75 to 80% of the population. So then our third update that was just if that happened is we've extended our grant payment. The final payment was anticipated to be in July of 2023, so we've extended it to September of 2023, an additional 2 months. And this is just a reminder, our applications close July 31st of 2022, so we need to make sure that we get all of our applications submitted by that date. So I just wanted to put that there.
Holly has her hand up.
And then I
Are you ready for me?
Yeah.
Okay. So I just had a question. I might have gotten the answer, but I don't. I forgot, I guess. Have you guys considered that licensing is now looking to upgrading or allowing family child care providers to increase their capacity? So if we do increase our capacity, technically our license capacity would raise. Are we going to also see an increase in our stabilization grant since that is based on our licensing capacity?
Yes. We'll issue those funds according to the new capacity size up to July 31st, 2022. After that point, it will stay at the previous capacity size.
Oh, I see. So if we don't increase our capacity before July of 2022, then our amount won't change after that, right?
Correct. And that's just because of the obligation.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Montana, one more slide.
There's one more question.
Oh, I'm sorry.
What date are the applications due?
We are accepting applications up to July 31st of 2022. And then this is just some information about our monthly reporting. It became available on April. And so the first monthly report was due May 5th for the current reporting requirements and also the overdue. So that would have been like those that received funding in January and February. There can be a grant reduction to the base rate if that enhanced rate criteria is not met, which is that majority or 51% of your staff receiving that minimum wage of $15 an hour. The reports are due on the 5th of each month. And then the payroll requirements for the enhanced base rate is documentation to validate and verify that majority of the staff need that $15 an hour. We just need the most current pay period for payments. We don't need a full month or a full year. With the monthly requirement, of course, you're going to be submitting those each month, but we just need the most recent pay period. And then again, the grant reduction to the base rate if the enhanced rate criteria is not met.
Holly had her hand up.
Holly?
Sorry, full of questions. So I've spoken to a few providers that are trying to increase their hire additional people for summertime. And so they don't necessarily have any documentation to verify that their summertime staff is paid at $15 an hour because they haven't worked yet. But is there like a list of things that they can submit, like even just something that says we intend to pay our providers this, so that they're hoping to get the funds in time to be able to pay those staff that $15 an hour. Otherwise, they don't really have the funds to pay that high so that they can show that they need the funds to pay that high, right?
For new applications, they do have 60 days to meet that criteria of the $15 an hour. But for ongoing recipients, they have to be able to verify that they are paying the majority $15 an hour before they are eligible for that enhanced rate.
Okay, so if I'm understanding this correctly, if they're already on the stabilization grant and they want to hire an employee for the first time this summer, they would have to hire them and pay them $15 an hour first before they could apply for the enhanced subsidy or enhanced payment?
Yes, we are accepting if somebody is hired and they're not going to receive a paycheck for like 2 weeks. Once it's a hire date and there is some sort of agreement that verifies that they are going to be receiving $15 per hour, we are accepting that because we understand that pay periods and paychecks are delayed.
Okay, that makes sense. Thank you.
Any other questions, Liz?
Okay, that was it for me.
Okay, thanks so much. Okay, so we'll turn the time over to Joellen for our CCQS update.
I'm going to move a little closer because I'm in timeout back there. I must have misbehaved.
You put yourself in timeout back there.
So it's so nice to be with everyone today. I always love opportunities to see real faces in person. It's always very exciting for me, so I'm happy to see you and give you this an opportunity to give you this update. So we have now rated 108 programs in the child care quality system since we've reopened the system. So we have a 29% participation rate when we look at the total number of programs that could apply. I've got the disbursement of the ratings. This is all center-based data, and these include everybody that applied both on the temporary and standard CCQS frameworks. So as you can see, 47% have rated at foundation of quality, 24% have rated at building quality, 25% at high quality, and 3.7% at high quality plus. So in our last rating on the 19th of last month, we got four new high quality programs, which for me is always super exciting news. It really delights me when that happens. So that's very exciting. Our current center data for rated centers, this is everybody that had the other thing I forgot to say that I really want to say is that we now have more rated centers than we did pre-pandemic. So when we closed in March of 2022, we only had 98 rated programs. And now we have 108, so I'm really excited about that too. But here's our data for those that we had data before. So we've had 28 programs that have applied that were never rated prior to the pandemic. So the things that we collect each month that we report to the feds are what I have put on this slide here. And that only accounts for those that we had a baseline for. So it's not all 108 programs. Does that make sense? So if we look here, we have about 57% of our rated programs have shown an observation score increase. So that's referring to, in the framework, they get a number of points based on their average scores across their observations. And 57% of our programs actually have had that score increase, which is pretty impressive. We also have had a 60% increase in the SAPQA observation scores from the previous scores. The education of director points overall have increased. 31% of the programs have increased those scores. And education of caregiver, 19% of the programs have increased. Overall point increase, this is referring to on the whole framework. So for all the different components, 56% of the programs that have been rated, that were rated previously, showed an overall increase. And an increase of certified rating, 20% of the programs. We have found we did have several building quality programs that now, unfortunately, our foundation makes sense with all the challenges that people have had. But I have also been very impressed with the number of programs that actually have been able to achieve high quality during this time. I think we have a lot of dedicated professionals in our state, and it's really exciting. So does anybody have any questions about the center data? Okay, so our next slide, we've got family child care data. And this just shows us, right now we have 132 programs that have received a certified rating, 18% of all licensed family child care providers. So you can see how it broke down here. 48 came in under default foundation of quality because they didn't score enough points to get the certified foundation. 37 out of 132 providers, or 28%, achieved that. And then for certified building,
we have 35.6% of our family providers that received a certified building quality. So this was all just based on the temporary framework. These providers were those that are eligible to apply in our early rating opportunity within the regular standard framework. So that application closed, and this is how our numbers came out. We had 69 programs apply, which was right about our estimate. So so it was not a surprise number, so 52%. The ratings, that the number of applications we received from each rating type are here. We have the most from building quality, which makes sense. They probably feel the most ready for observation. So so we have the most from them. The next group, of course, is the certified foundation, and then the default foundation comprised the rest of them. So, yeah, so we have already done the randomization and assigned observation months for the family child care programs. And we are pleased to announce that we anticipate being able to open the application to all family child care programs 2 to 3 months ahead of what we had originally projected. So it will probably be November of this year that any child care provider that hasn't already applied will have the opportunity to apply for a rating. There will be no more temporary framework. All of that will be sunsetted, and we'll just be back into our regular system. So we are already doing initial visits and family programs this month and getting ready for observations in the family programs next month. So this is an exciting step for our crew that does the work. Next slide, please, Montana. So I just wanted to kind of give you a high level of what is coming next now that we have the system. We've got ratings, we've got it going, we're opening to family. And talk about our support system at a high level. We've done a lot of work to provide additional support to programs during the pandemic. The things on this slide are things that we've been doing that we will continue to do. So the first five on this slide, are supports that the first four on the slide are supports we offer to anyone. So whether or not you've engaged with us, whether or not you had a rating, no matter, you know, whatever it is, these are the supports that we have that can help you understand best practices, that can provide support to you or your staff. So we have the ERS best practices courses. So those are the in-depth courses about individual items in the different rating tools that we use. They are all completed now, 100% of them, even all our family child care courses. So, and they're $5, and a person can enroll, and as long as they attend the class, they'll get a voucher to attend another class. So you could effectively pay $5 and take every single class for $5. Now that is a deal, folks. That is a deal. So, if they miss the class and they don't go, then they would have to re-register and pay for the next class. But it is possible. So that is for anybody. Best practices support groups, these have been going since January. They've been available in center-based programs since January, I should say. We just started our first family one this month. So family providers have one just for their tool, and we'll be beginning also having them monthly for the school-age tool in June. So these are, for at least center-based programs, they're mostly during the day. We actually get better attendance during the day. From center-based family child care, we often have to adjust to evening hours for obvious reasons. We also have our CCQS specialist consultation within all of our different Care About Child Care agencies. Any provider can access that support. And we have our Ask an Anchor email and bi-monthly office hours that this is manned by my program specialists that are all state anchors, meaning they train regularly with ERSI. They're certified by ERSI. And so a provider can email the Ask an Anchor email address and say, hey,
maybe they had an observation and they have a question about it, or maybe they just have a question in general, they can give their question and they can ask us to reply via email, text, or phone call. So we'll accommodate whatever they ask. And we also have two times a month that we just have open office hours. We send out a Zoom link. Anybody can join. They can stand for 5 minutes. They can stand for 2 hours if they want to and listen to everybody else's questions. But it's available. So all of those things are available to everybody all the time. The next three are kind of considered the next tier of support. So if we look at the work we do in sending out our observers to programs, even if programs don't get high quality, that opportunity they have to receive observation feedback and know where they are in those classrooms is support. In our state, we don't charge to provide those observations. There's a lot of states in the quality system that the centers pay for them, and we do not. So this is, we consider support as well. Just the fact that we go out, we provide those observations, we bring this personally back to you. Sometimes we do it virtually, depending on what the program prefers. But that is a service to programs, but it's definitely a support. We also have a new family child care peer learning community cohort beginning. We just ended one. This is our biggest one. We have 75 applications, and we were able to accommodate all of them. So this is the biggest number we served at one time. We will begin our peer learning community cohorts for centers again. We'll have one, and that group will be selected in July of 2022. Next slide, Montana. So here is what's coming as far as intensive support. So programs that have a rating will be accepting applications from eligible programs from July 1st to the 19th of this year. Every year thereafter, there will be an open application window from January 1st to 15th and July 1st to 15th. And programs that have current rating of building quality or a foundation of quality rating with 60 points on the framework. Those are the programs that will currently be eligible to apply this first time around. Programs do not write a proposal. There's no grant writing involved whatsoever. There's a rubric that we use, and we plug in all the data, so we look at, you know, points are allocated for the number of subsidy children a program has, the percentage of subsidy children a program has. What their total points are in the framework. And so there's different criteria. We will publish the rubric when we send out the application invitation. Only those that are eligible will receive that invitation to apply. And they will be able to look at the rubric and see how it's going. So we'll plug in everything from the rubric. We'll do it regionally, so that we make sure that there's programs in every region that are served. And we also have a formula we're using that makes it fair according to percentage. And I could explain that all to you, but I don't have time. So, but that will all be explained, so programs will know how we're doing it, how we're applying it. And then the programs will be selected in each region up to the number of classrooms we can serve in that region that we have capacity for. So then once we do that, those programs will enter into a contract with the Office of Child Care and receive intense on-site coaching using the practice-based coaching model. And I know a lot of you have done baby steps. A lot of providers have done some of our other programs. This is much more intense. The whole object of this is to help people get to that high quality marker. So each coach is assigned less classrooms than we've done in the past so that they can be in the programs frequently. There is a component of working with the administrative team and center staff, but it's a big commitment on the part of providers. So we'll have more information coming out that will educate providers. If you apply for this, this is what this is what you're asking for. So you want to know, right? So we'll allocate all those slots, and then We will have, for people that don't score high enough to make it in on this round, we will have six programs that we'll be able to provide peer learning community support for. So, yeah. So there it is, folks, in a nutshell. Any questions? Okay, it was a pleasure to share this with you today. Thank you.
Thank you, Joellen. Okay, so professional development, Heather.
I have a few updates that I wanted to share in the professional development realm. So one of those is a policy update. We expanded our eligibility for our Child Development Associate Credential, or CDA, scholarship. Before, someone had to work at least 15 hours a week in a program that cares for children birth through age 12 in Utah. But we've also added an additional eligibility component, or instead of that, you could be a high school student completing an early childhood education skills certificate. So those high school students that are interested in working in the early childhood field can also work towards their CDA along with their early childhood education skills certificate and receive our scholarship for that credential. That's the first update. And then my other updates, last time we met, I talked about the Salt Lake Community College Family, the Center Child Care Business Fundamentals course. We have now launched the Family Child Care Business Fundamentals course, which just started this month and will happen in May and June. We got a lot of great feedback from the Center Child Care course that took place in March and April, and so we're excited to expand that out to the family child care programs as well. We have some new curriculum. It's called our Explore More series. It's replacing our Back to the Basics series, and there is a class on art, music, STEM, and enriching activities. So check that out if you haven't yet. Those are in place now, and then we have some updated curriculum. We updated our child care quality system from application to award for centers course, which is now being taught again, and then we are adapting that to the family child care version, which should be coming soon. The other thing I wanted to highlight is the our early education payback program scholarship that we have put in place with our stimulus funding. We have been doing a marketing push and a press release. A press release just went out last week from Department of Workforce Services, and we have had some news outlets publish some articles in Fox News and KUER on our scholarship program, and are just working on also reaching people via social media and getting that information out to students that might be eligible that are majoring in early childhood or a related major, and that they are eligible for this scholarship if they're working at least 15 hours a week within a licensed childcare program. So hoping that it will be a good recruitment tool for our child care programs and meet the needs of those students that are in those majors as well. And there's more information about that scholarship. I put the link at the bottom of the slide. Any questions? Oh, one more update. We have had 29 people. We opened that program, the Early Ed Payback Program, in November. We've had 29 scholarships that have been approved for over $72,000, and we have 15 that just applied recently at the end of this spring semester that are already in the queue, but you have 3 months after the semester is over to apply for that tuition reimbursement.
Looks like we don't have any questions.
Great.
So, yep, we're going to turn the time over to Ann now with the subsidy update.
So I have three changes to report on. The first is, as you recall, Rebecca had mentioned in the last meeting that we were changing our administrative rules and our policy to change the definition of legal work. And so we need to update our state plan to match. And so I plan to submit that this month. I've just been waiting because we might have some additional licensing changes to putting that same amendment. We'll know more tomorrow after the licensing committee. But basically those changes are around updating the group size and the ratio requirements from House Bill 15, and also requiring pre-service training before children can be cared for without supervision. So if that's not in this amendment, it'll be in the following amendment that I do. And then I also wanted to report on some upcoming subsidy policy changes. So when the last market rate study was completed, 82% of center providers said that they charge a registration fee. And the regulations require that states pay for reasonable mandatory registration fees that are charged to private paying parents. So in our state plan, when we updated it last year, we included that we were requesting programming changes to be able to accomplish this. So effective August 1st, we're planning to cover the cost of initial registration fees for up to $50 per child for licensed centers and $40 per child for licensed family providers. And those numbers come from the survey also. That was the average amount that providers reported that their fees were. And so this will affect subsidy families that are enrolling in child care facility for the first time in a current 12-month period. And DWS will pay for one initial registration fee per child for each new provider in a 12-month period. So when they change, we'll pay for that new provider. If they go back to the old provider, we'll look back to see if they received a fee within the last 12 months. If not, then we'll pay them. If they did, then we won't pay them a second time in that 12-month period.
What if they go to five centers in 12 months?
If all five centers charge a fee, then we would pay it five times. And that does happen. Yeah, we talked about that. So, but it's to be fair to all providers, and each provider will cover that. So providers report the way that we're getting that data is that they report their initial registration fee and care about child care on the same page where they update their rates. And so that information will just pull into our eligibility system so that we can identify if they are charging a fee or not, and then we'll pay them. It'll also show in our provider portal so that providers will be able to see that we've made that payment.
It'll show in a different line item.
Okay. Yeah. So any questions on that?
No, but thank you.
So we've you know, had some struggles with programming just because there's so many other projects within our department that need to get programmed, and so it has taken a while. So we're hoping that August 1st, that thing won't change. And then the other one is that we talked about commercial preschools being eligible and meeting CCDF requirements. So they are considered a DWS eligible provider type. And so starting September 10th, they also will be eligible to receive subsidy payments. And again, the reason for that date is because of programming. You have to be able to actually program that provider type into our. That's all that I had. Any questions on anything? All right, thank you.
Great, thank you, Anne. So we'll just move up on to our agency updates, and it looks like we have Sarah Atherton for Simone with our child care licensing.
Good afternoon, everybody. I'll be very quick as we're running really short on time. The 2022 compliance draft from child care licensing has been released. It was released Monday at 8 a.m. We sent out pre-release information on April 15th in order to give the providers time to prepare for the grant application. It is a Google form, so they need to fill it out in one sitting. We did not set a funding limit on this. We wanted to be equitable as well as equal. This allows us to fund what providers need for licensing compliance and hopefully fund it in full. We put a lot more we learned a lot from the previous grants. We pulled in some providers to help us create our application. So we had two provider groups that helped us, two provider committees. We also provided a detailed instruction sheet on the grant and in the process. We hosted webinars for the applicants where they could ask questions, and we did it all in English and in Spanish. So, yeah, we're on fire now. That's all I have.
Great. Do we have any questions or anything for Sarah? No? Great. Okay, Jared, we're going to turn it over to you.
Okay, thanks, Rhonda. Go ahead. Next slide. Okay, I just have a few, hopefully they'll be very brief updates, because I know we're running short on time and we still need to have time for the public comment period. The first update is that we're currently in the public feedback section of the English Language Arts Early Learning Standard. Now, probably a lot of you are thinking, wait, didn't we just get brand new Early Learning Standards? We did. The Early Learning Standards were approved in 2020. With the last revamp, the Early Learning Standards have been moved in line for re-looking at and updating with the K through 12 standards. It's now the pre-K through 12 standards, or the Early Learning through 12, and that's why it's being updated currently. The English Language Arts section was one that we received quite a bit of feedback after, a lot of questions. Here's your chance if you want to help guide the development of the new English Language Arts Early Learning Standards. You can follow the link that's on this slide to go to, it's a Qualtrics survey. It has a link to the proposed standards. Just a warning, it has the preschool through 12 standards in them. You just need to focus on the early learning standards, the preschool ones. But please do go to that site and review them, and any feedback that you have on the proposed updated early learning standards for English Language Arts, please submit those by June 14th. Go ahead to the next slide, Montana. And the next thing is, coming up this summer, we have the Standards Implementation Institute. This is a series of professional learning opportunities that will be delivered throughout the state. There are 7 locations. The first one is scheduled for Richfield during the week of June 6th. So it's coming up very, very quickly. What these are there's a series of trainings on how to take the standards, and you know, there's some preschool sections and then the early learning integration standards to integrate into the classroom. The cost of this is $105 per person per day. There should be some funding available through, you know, perhaps the COVID relief funding or other funding that could be used to defray this cost. There's the link on this slide here, as well as on the PDF document that's attached to the meeting materials, if you would like to have more information on these. It should be a very good, very powerful professional learning opportunity. And like I said, there's seven different sessions offered throughout the state, and so please watch for those coming up. Go ahead, the next slide. Okay, the third update is we're currently in, you know, coming up on the end of the academic year for a lot of programs, and so it's the PEEP exit testing window. The School Readiness Board opened up the PEEP data submission to any program that wants to submit. Any public or private program can submit PEEP scores. The gateway, the window is the last, technically the last 4 weeks of the program, but if it's a full year program, there's a problem with that because the scores need to be submitted by June 15th. If your program, or if a program is interested in participating in the PEEP, you know, submitting the PEEP exit data, they will need to contact Jonathan Collins at schools.utah.gov to have the transfer system set up so they can submit scores. The deadline for submitting that request is May 15th. And so if my math is right, that's coming up in about 4 days. I think it's Sunday, which I'm not sure if anybody wants to be doing that on Sunday. So if you're interested in participating in your program, participating in submitting PEEP exit data, please reach out to Jonathan Collins this week to help start the process. One last reminder on this is that there was a typographical error in the previous teacher administration manual, the one from June 2020, where item number 9, which is rote counting, was said it was worth 1 point if it's counting up to 10, and then it was like 2 points if it was like 6 to 10. We fixed it in subsequent manuals, but if you have an old manual, please be aware of this for the scoring so that we don't have some messed up data, messed up information. Okay, one more slide. The last thing, this is a coming soon, kind of a little teaser here. We, at the State Board of Education, you know, the staff has been working on some parent guides to go along with the Utah Early Learning Standard. Basically, these are ideas and strategies that parents can do at home or in a variety of locations working with their children to help support children's learning relating to the current early learning standards. Those will be coming up. Don't have an exact date. We've been working on them. They'll be going through the process of, you know, making it all pretty, and you know, they'll be coming out soon. But just wanted to give everybody a heads up, especially if you're looking for opportunities for parent and family engagement. These should be some very good resources for you, for programs to use with families.
Will you send that out to providers as well as parents?
What it will be is most likely it will be linked, or it'll be along with the preschool pathways website on the UEN site. There won't be a printed document. We're going away from printing. There will most likely be a PDF document, most likely available through the preschool pathways at uan.org, that parents can access this. But as far as working with parents and reaching out with parent engagement, this will be a great resource to use with them. Good question. Okay, I think, this is just the flyer for the Standards Implementation Institute. I believe that's all the updates that we have. Are there any questions for me?
When do you anticipate the parent guide? Just curious.
So, the internal deadline for those, we finished them, the preschool group finished them this last week, but it needs to go through like the editing and then the typesetting and all those. So I would not expect them to be available until probably the earliest would be late summer.
Okay.
But I'm sure in future updates I'll be able to have more information on those. But this is just kind of like a coming soon, you know, yeah, heads up.
Do you have it in Spanish?
We're planning on doing it in Spanish also, yeah.
Great, thanks. Thanks a lot. So I guess at this time right now, I'm just going to ask from the board if there's any other business at this point. Looks like nice and quiet. Thank you. And we also, this is another time we ask for public comment.
For the public comment, if you're a member of the public and want to do a comment, if you just click the raise hand feature, Montana will unmute your mic and elevate you to be able to speak. Thank you. No?
All right. Well, thanks. Okay. Thanks, everybody, for attending. I'm going to call.
Oh, sorry. Before you do that, one person.
Oh, no, that's fine. Oh, Simone.
Sorry, thank you. Just a quick thank you to Montana. She's doing a wonderful job. She took away my storm. I always had a correction to made in the minutes, but it's been a long time since I haven't had to do that because of her wonderful job. Thank you, Montana.
Motion to adjourn.
We have a second.